Want to hear one of my favorite sounds? That's the sound I hear when I get one of the questions right on Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. I've been saying I wanted to learn another language for the longest time now, and I'm finally doing it this year with Babbel. I signed up for French because there's a lot of medical history that I'm interested in that was originally written in French. Plus, I've always wanted to travel to France, and when I finally get there, I'd like to be able to get around. Now, Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and they're rooted in real-life situations delivered with conversation-based teaching, so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I actually recorded my first lesson in French. Here, take a listen. Matching au revoir to goodbye.
Au revoir.
Au revoir. When will I get the cool accent?
Bonjour.
All right. Got it. Now, that's just my first lesson, so don't judge me or my accent. But I did pick up on a few things that I thought were interesting. There's a lot of spaced repetition and cognitive flexibility being used in their lessons, and I've been pretty impressed so far with the program. The app and regular website are both super easy to use and look great, and the lessons can be done in 10 minutes or less. So far, I feel like I'm learning a lot, and we have a very special deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, babbel.com/barbellpod. That's BABBEL.com/barbellpod. There's rules and restrictions may apply, but 60% off. Check them out, guys.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
It's the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. If you're a new listener, welcome to the Barbell Medicine Podcast series. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. Love to share this time with you. This week is episode 159. This is part one of Dr. Baraki and I's question and answer session from a recent two-day seminar at Untamed Strength in Sacramento, California. We talk about dietary variety, fairness in sports, change in beliefs, and much, much more. You're going to love it, I promise. First up, let's get to some announcements. If you're in the United States, it's the week of Thanksgiving, and that means turkey, time with loved ones, and of course, sales. Here at Barbell Medicine, we're actually doing a week of wellness that kicks off on Wednesday, November 24th. Many of our products and services will be on sale from Wednesday through Monday, November 29th. Stay tuned to our Instagram and Facebook pages for announcements. If you're signed up for our newsletter, we'll drop you these friendly little reminders in your inbox so you don't miss a sale. We've also got some great new products, including templates. We've got the Low Fatigue Strength Template coming out, Power Building 3, Hip Pain Rehab, Super Total, a couple other cool ones that are going to drop as well, including some new apparel and potentially a book on programming that may be available as well. That's a stretch goal for me to finish up in the next 24 hours or so. Additionally, we have some more seminars coming up. In January, Dr. Baraki, myself, and the rest of the Barbell Medicine crew will be in Miami at the new Ghost Gym for a two-day seminar. That's going to be a fun one. Also, we'll be in Philadelphia in March, and the Pain and Rehab crew will have their own two-day seminar. They'll be in Oregon in March. Spots are limited at these events, so get registered today by following the link in the description below. For the last part of this intro, I briefly wanted to talk about my most recent powerlifting meet that took place last weekend in Palmdale, California. If you have no desire to hear about this, which is understandable, you just fast forward for the next 10 minutes, delete it out of your brain, and get right to the Q&A. Okay, if you are interested in hearing about this, so I had signed up for this meet about 3 months ago, which gave me ample time to prepare. Recently, what I've been doing is if training had been going well, I would just kind of find a meet that was about a month away and kind of show up and compete. I got this wild hair to beat my all-time best total, which I actually set in knee wraps back in 2014. I totaled 815 kilos, which is 1,795 pounds between the squat, bench press, and deadlift. And training had been going so well that I thought, hey, I think I could do this in knee sleeves, and that would be a pretty cool goal for me. So I signed up for this meet about 3 months ago. If you're interested in seeing a more detailed look at how my training was going, you can check out YouTube. I posted a bunch of training vlogs on there, and yeah, training was going well. I had squatted 290 kilos or 291 kilos, which is 640 in knee sleeves. That was an all-time PR. I had pulled 738, which tied my all-time best deadlift in the gym. I had been benching well into the 420-pound range, which was not a PR level, but it looked like if it all came together at the meet, I was going to be able to total at least 817.5 kilos or eclipse the 1,800-pound mark. So I was pretty excited about that. However, as things tend to do when everything's going well, kind of went sideways there. About 4 weeks prior to the meet, I got sick. I don't know what I had. I mean, I tested negative for COVID and every other test that I had been, you know, given when I actually went to the doctor. But I was feeling just extreme amounts of fatigue. I was dizzy when I stood up. I couldn't sleep for more than a few minutes at a time. And I was straight up not having a good time. I did have some fevers at night for a while there, about a month out. I missed a bunch of training sessions just because I was feeling so poorly. So at that point, I was thinking about, man, maybe I should try to find another meet. But things started coming around. I felt a little bit better, well enough to train. I didn't feel like I was an infectious risk given that everything was negative. And so I was able to start training again. And things were going okay. I still didn't feel great, you know, for the last 2 weeks or so of prep. But I thought I felt well enough to go to the meet, put forth my best effort, and that if things went my way, I could probably hit that PR total. So in any case, I went to the meet. Again, this was last week, and I still didn't feel great. And I don't want to harp on that too much, use it as an excuse, but I mean, really, this is not the way you want to come into a meet. I just thought, you know, training had been going so well, and I still felt strong. The week of the actual meet, I squatted 275 kilos. It was going to be like my opener attempt. So, you know, 606, and that moved really well. I benched up to 192.5 kilos, which is 422 pounds, I believe. And then I pulled 705, just what I thought was going to be an easy opener. So, and it all felt fine. So I was like, you know, here we go. Let's do the thing. So yeah, get to the meet, get changed into the Borat suit, you know, the singlet. And I thought, let's do this thing. Warm-ups for squats. I had Claire in the warm-up room. She was helping me out. They felt fine. My last warm-up, I think, was 535 or 545. And yeah, it felt fine. I mean, again, I was still pretty dizzy, not like dangerously so. And I was still tired, but again, not dangerously so. And I just, was ready to start the meet. So first two attempts were fine. I didn't feel anything as far as like, wow, my leg really hurts or any sort of warning sign about what was going to happen on the third attempt. Third attempt, walked out, squatted down to the bottom, and I hear pop, 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 and then an extreme pain running from my groin all the way down to the inside of my knee. Super unstable. Luckily, I didn't dump the weight because dumping all that weight on my head would have been badness. But, you know, there were 7 or 8 spotters on the platforms to help me get the bar back into the rack. Immediately, I was able to walk, just not quickly. But yeah, I just severe pain in the inside of my leg. I had initially suspected that, you know, maybe I tore my adductor or hamstring or some sort of, muscular injury like that. I didn't really know, although it's about a 2.5-hour, 3-hour drive from where the meet was back to San Diego. So at the meet, I was like, well, I didn't get the squat number. I needed to squat 290. Didn't get that. The best I had at that point was 282.5. And yeah, I could bench something without any leg drive or with minimal leg drive. But I don't think I could hit my best. I could have probably benched in the, you know, low 180s maybe. So just maybe at 400 pounds. So, which is not what I needed to hit my PR total. And then I didn't know what I could deadlift. I thought maybe with adrenaline and some weird stiff legged kind of deadlift thing, I could probably pull in the low 500s, but none of that was going to be enough to hit the PR total. So I just bagged the meet, left, drove home. So yeah, it's about a 3-hour drive. When I got home, the entire inside of my thigh was super bruised. There was no like big pocket, like a hematoma, like a big blood, you know, kind of collection, but it was pretty bruised and tender and sore. And, honestly, the worst pain that I felt was when I got out of my truck, when I got home. I'd just been sitting there for 3 hours and it just, that stationary kind of time elapse was not great for me. I almost fell, but yeah, I was walking relatively normally, just standing up quickly, going quick, fast. Like, if I had to walk fast, that wasn't great for the initially. And again, the bruise, it all led me to believe that I had adductor tear. But at the same time, I didn't really know because, you know, I didn't have any imaging. I just thought, let's see how it goes over the next few days and go from there. So I was able to play golf the next day. It was pretty bad, like walking up some of the hills. Like, that didn't feel that great. But actually swinging a golf club was fine, so that was encouraging. And even Dr. Derek Miles, who I consulted with later on how to get started on my rehab process, and I'll share some of that with you guys in the upcoming content, he was like, look, when you told me you play golf, I got a lot less worried about how this was going to go for you. So, and then 48 hours out, I was able to squat. I think I squatted 65 pounds to pins. And 72 hours out, I was able to deadlift 70 kilos. And then by the end of the week, I belt squatted, I think, 275, and conventional deadlifted 265 for 15s. The thing that hurts the most is trying to go fast. So the velocity thing is tough. There's just shooting pain on the inside of my leg. I feel like it's getting better day by day, but, and I kind of was curious as to, like, hey, like, what actually happened? Am I just going to call this an adductor tear, or just do I have thigh pain? So I ended up getting an ultrasound, on my leg. Yeah, it was pretty easy to get in and see a doctor, fortunately. And yeah, it looks like there was a tear on my adductor longus and magnus. Pretty substantial tear, nice little collection of blood in there that looked to be resolving. Most of the bruising and swelling has gone down. But yeah, there was no tendon involvement. And due to, like, my symptoms that I could squat and deadlift, walk normally, play golf, and the fact that the bruising had resolved and there was no tendon involvement, basically conservative management, you know, just physical activity modification and symptom management is kind of the key here. So that's what I'm going to be doing. How I felt after the meet, I was pretty bummed about it, to be honest. I had prepped for so long and training was going so well. And in addition, I had made it so public, you know, like, I'm going to this meet, and that, I think that was cool. Like, I just like people being on the journey with me, but it just felt like a big letdown, you know, like somebody popped my balloon, let the air out of the whole experience. And so I was pretty bummed about it, frustrated that it didn't all come together. You know, I understand it's going to be like that, but I was really hoping that this meet, you know, was my return to glory. You know, that was Tiger Woods' comeback in 2019. That's what Jim Nantz said when he finally won another major championship. And I understand that this is a major championship. It's just a local powerlifting meet. But I thought, man, if I could beat that total, that would be my return. And yeah, it just didn't work out that way. And so pretty bummed about it and frustrated. So that's wearing off. And I'm kind of in the rehab mindset now. I know that I'm going to get better. I know that I'm going to be back on the platform at some point. I'm more happy that I feel great now. I mean, I'm not having any problems sleeping anymore. I don't feel tired or dizzy or anything like that. So whatever junk I was carrying around is resolved, and I feel much better. So we'll see what happens. And silver lining, now I get to share a bunch of rehab content with you. So this week, what I'm going to do on Friday, Black Friday, in addition to, again, some of our sales stuff, I'll be dropping the video highlighting the rest of my prep for the meet, all the content I have on that, kind of summarizing how that all went leading into the meet. And then next week, we'll start with the rehab content. We'll show you guys my workouts, my consultation with Dr. Miles, and then kind of the plan going forward. I'm hoping, you know, 6 to 8 weeks, I'll be back. Hopefully squatting, you know, somewhere in the 300s, somewhere in there, and pulling about the same. And that'd be good progress, because I think I'd like to be back to normal and considering a meet by the end of Q1 2022. Maybe competing sometime in the late spring, early summer of 2022 if I get motivated and training's going well. So we'll see. Hopefully you enjoyed hearing some of that. I mean, not the most exciting stuff. I wish I could have told you, yeah, I went out and hit all my numbers and everything was great, and I got a sweet, sweet medal, but didn't work out like that. So in any case, I get to share with you guys the rehab process, and hopefully you guys find that useful as well. I think it's really nice, I'll say this, to have the great support system that I do with my friends and my colleagues here. I think that is a privilege that obviously not everyone has. So that's been super useful, being able to talk to folks, level-minded folks who are really up on rehab and pain science and stuff. That's been useful. And then just friends, you know, because they empathize, they get it. And all the support that you guys showed me via Instagram, in my DMs, and on Facebook, in our Facebook group, that was all really, really awesome. I just wish it would have gone better. So anyway, enough from me. Let's hop in to this week's podcast. Again, this is episode 159, part one of Dr. Baraki and I's question and answer session from Sacramento, California at Untamed Strength.
All right. So thank you guys so much for coming to the Sacramento edition of the Barbell Medicine Seminar here at Untamed Strength. Thank you. No one clapped. Okay. Sometimes there's applause, sometimes there's not. It's a hit and miss.
We'll edit that out.
Yeah, no, I will. Yeah, when you say we'll edit that out, right, yeah, I'll edit that out. Sure. If you have to leave during the Q&A, don't worry about it. Thank you. Understand. Thanks for coming. If your question is not answered, it's because Leah doesn't like you. Or we've answered it. Yeah, people believe that. Or we have maybe answered it in some previous content. We're still happy to answer it, so you can post it on our forum, on our Facebook group, or probably the most active person on social media in the Barbell Medicine crew is Alan Thrall, and he loves DMs. He likes answering them and engaging in them all day. So 10 out of 10 would recommend sending your DMs to Untamed Strength. He'll answer them. He's also a doctor, so it's great. All right. Question number one, any evidence for eating the rainbow, i.e. any unique benefits of a range of colored fruit and vegetables, phytonutrients, red flag, I like the inclusion of the red flag. Because like, how did you find that emoji like on like it's Microsoft Word?
It's so hot right now.
It is so hot, but I'm just like, this is in your Google Docs. Yeah. So Google knows. That's impressive. I would want people to eat a wide variety of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, lean proteins, all that sort of stuff as part of a health-promoting dietary pattern. I think when people ask this question, what they really mean is, in a given day or in a week, do I really need to have X amount of variation in my vegetable intake and or fruit intake? And the answer to that is no. You can have a highly repeatable diet. I think that as the seasons change and as different fruits and vegetables come into and go out of season, you know, altering them based on your dietary preferences and what's available to you is preferable. But I'll end this, at least this first part, by saying, I don't know that if you have a much higher variation of vegetable intake compared to a lower variation of vegetable intake, but the overall fiber intake and number of servings is the same, if there's a unique benefit there. And I certainly don't think that is, you know, accessible for a lot of people to, you know, eat a super wide range of vegetables and fruits, because it's not even accessible for a lot of people to eat fresh fruits and vegetables, period. So as far as phytonutrients, are they a thing? Yes, in fact, phytonutrients, you know, flavonoids and all these other different components of fruits and vegetables that seem to have unique health-promoting effects are in fact real. And it's one of the reasons why we don't see the relationship between supplemental dietary fiber and good health outcomes. We don't see the same sort of relationship that we see with people who actually eat more fruits and vegetables, save for like the LDL or lipid-lowering effect that we see with high amounts of supplemental dietary fiber. So when people are having a problem meeting their sort of daily fiber goal and their first itch is to like reach for supplemental dietary fiber, I usually try to find solutions to consume more fruits and vegetables, because I think there are unique health promoting effects there compared to consuming supplemental dietary fiber. If you have want to lower your lipids, triglycerides much further, and you can use high amounts of supplemental dietary fiber to do so, that works. But as far as the other like health promoting effects of fruits and vegetables, they do seem to be unique to consuming dietary fiber from them.
Yeah, I agree that consuming a variety of fruits and vegetables varying colors when you can, to the extent you can, is in general a good recommendation. I did want to tackle this latter part of the question, because it seems like they're asking phytonutrients with the red flag emoji. Is it like they're asking, is this something that should be a red flag for like quackery or something like that? And this is like definitely no. Phytonutrients are basically non-energy containing nutrients that are unique to certain plant sources, meaning they don't provide calories, but there are other plant compounds that do have biological effects in the body and have health impacting effects, present primarily in plant foods. Like you mentioned, flavonoids, polyphenols are another one. These are some of the things that are present in things like olive oil, like dark chocolate, cruciferous vegetables, dark berries, things like that have plenty of these in particular. There's tons of foods that have them. That's just a few common examples. Some of them have been studied for, you know, unique benefits of some of these compounds in the context of cardiovascular disease or like dementia risk and things like that. I don't think it's worth going way too far down the rabbit hole of worrying about it at that level, rather just recognizing that these things exist, they're real, they're not a red flag for a quack who's talking about them, and you should consume a wide variety of them. But as it pertains to these sort of plant components, what is more of a red flag, and I think this is worth addressing, is if you hear people talk about things like quote-unquote anti-nutrients that are present in plant foods, or lectins, or phytates, or other things like that, that truly are real things that exist and they're present in plant foods, and you will hear certain folks talk about these things, in particular carnivore dieters. They talk about these things as things that are present in plants that were effectively because plants are trying to not get eaten, and so they're trying to poison animals so that they don't get eaten. And they basically use this to make an argument that vegetables are toxic. This is literally a thing that certain carnivore diet proponents will say, and that you should avoid all vegetables because they contain these sort of anti-nutrients, right? And while some of these compounds are a real thing, one of the most common issues that is a big red flag with these people who are in these diet circles is they tend to find some sort of a biological mechanism like this, be it a quote-unquote anti-nutrient kind of effect, or they may find some sort of a petri dish type mechanism and blow it way out of proportion, ignoring all the evidence for benefit in real-world outcomes of people consuming lots of vegetables, right? Same thing happens when they talk about polyunsaturated fatty acids. They say, you know, there's this one possible mechanism that a polyunsaturated fatty acid could contribute to inflammation, and ignore all the evidence that they do not increase inflammation, they do not increase heart disease, they do not increase these things. And the same thing applies here. So I wanted to say, obviously, the phytonutrient thing, real thing, beneficial compounds, worth eating lots of vegetables. What is a red flag is this other side that you will come across if you read probably more than you should about nutrition on the internet.
Yeah, mechanistic studies, clinical outcome studies.
Yes, much heavier weight. We put a lot more weight on studies that actually look at real human outcomes rather than potential petri dish type of mechanisms and things like that.
Yeah, while interesting.
Hypothesis generating, that's what we call those.
Not interesting enough.
All right.
What is the most rewarding or fulfilling part of your teaching/coaching work, and what is the hardest part? Well, I'll tell you the most rewarding part is arguing with strangers on the internet about their opinions on it. For my money, I just tell you, you know. Never gets old, never. Probably two things that are, I think they're pretty disparate. So I really enjoy when professionals, either fitness or medical, but definitely medical professionals, reach out and say, hey, this has either changed my practice or changed how I'm talking to patients or changed my opinion on something that I was really kind of emboldened on. That's just, I mean, that's one of the reasons why this thing exists, you know, and I think because it's so special to us, just given our training, to hear another medical provider be like, yeah, so you changed my mind. I'm like, wait, what? How though? Tell me how. That's really, really powerful. The other part is seeing somebody accomplish something they never thought they'd be able to do from a physical standpoint. So that's just from coaching. And, you know, when I initially started coaching people in person, it'd be like someone who had lost a lot of weight and now can do a chin-up or whatever. And then now it'd be a post-op person who then benches over their body weight, like the post-shoulder repair. Or they previously had this very debilitating back pain and now they deadlift some crazy amount. Or like Leah, for example, even. When we first started, she could barely lift the pink dumbbells, right? No offense to the pink dumbbells, but they were barely getting lifted by Leah. And she could only safety squat, bar squat. And then, you know, years later, she's at IPF Worlds. Are you kidding me? Like, man, that was cool. I still cool. Not like you're not washed up. You're fine. The hardest part for me is trying not to get bogged down in the stuff that doesn't matter, and that tends to be the strangers that are trying to argue with you or waste your time on the internet. And because it's not a sense of wanting to be right, it's a sense of wanting to make sure that your message is clear and, you know, undiluted and not being compromised by people saying or writing certain things. And it's like, do you have to answer everyone? Obviously the answer is no. But at some point you feel like, well, I put this out there and these people are responding and I need to make sure that what I'm saying is clear. And it is difficult to kind of let that go, and it doesn't necessarily bother me like on a personal level. It's just a time suck. You'd spend that time doing better stuff. Sure. Yeah. Also, I'm not great at editing videos, and that's a really hard thing for me to do, but we're working on it, and putting out more YouTube content is something we're really trying to push. So, all right.
I will say that in part, Jordan stole my answer in that before this, my exact same answer was, as far as fulfillment, seeing somebody do something that they did not think they were going to be able to do. I would extend it beyond just physical things, because obviously I do coach people in, you know, lifting, strength training, performance, things like that, and see this all the time. Well, they'll start training and then we get someplace and they're like, man, I did not see myself getting this far when we started, did not see myself hitting this milestone, whatever the case is. That's cool. But I also spend a fair amount of my time teaching medicine in a hospital and teaching really complicated medicine to trainees, junior doctors, medical students, with some of the sickest patients in the hospital are internal medicine patients that have 12 different problems and all kinds of different organ failure things. And so it's really intimidating for a student to come in, right, and to have to like present their first patient to me or something like that. And then, you know, over the course of a rotation, or more recently, I had an individual who I had as a student, and then I had as a first year resident, and then I had as a second year resident, and I've been able to see this progression of where they started, kind of like a where we started and where we are now kind of thing. And that is super fulfilling, and I can see this progression from med students don't know anything, to next year is going to be a colleague, which is super cool, very rewarding because of how complicated some of the things that we have to wrap our minds around, how complicated some of the decisions are that we have to make, life and death decisions with people. So coaching, getting people to, you know, their first milestone lift, 2-plate, 3-plate, 4-plate, whatever the case is, you know, lift that people get super psyched about. And then also seeing people accomplish things that, you know, they may have been super intimidated by or didn't think that they were going to get to this point of skill, independent decision making, or ask, what do you think is going on? And then they're like, man, I've seen this before. I know how to walk through this and think about this. And, you know, they're able to like manage things independently. So I find that super fulfilling.
All right. If you had to speculate, are most of the people with obesity in our modern food environment obesity sensitive, and most that don't have obesity, obesity resistant? I mean, by definition, yeah. And I would say that, again, if we're using by definition, that most people, period, are obesity sensitive, just given the rates of obesity globally.
I think the reason that I wanted to include this question is to really hammer home the point that, like, obesity, just like every other disease state that we've talked about, high blood pressure, cholesterol issues, diabetes, whatever the case is, it is the emergence, the result of an interaction between genes and environment. That is like the main paradigm of this kind of stuff, the interaction between genes and environment. Because we will hear people say, why has obesity increased in prevalence so much in the past 50 years, 100 years, human genes have not changed that much in the past 50 years, 100 years. There's not been massive human evolution in the past century, right? It's because the environment has changed so dramatically, right? And the expression of those same genes that we've had in this new environment that is engineered in a certain way to hit those centers in our brain that really get us going, crank up our appetite, buy more, consume more, et cetera. That interaction is what leads to the emergence of this phenomenon that we observe as obesity. Obesity is like the symptom of all of this, practically, right? The underlying issues are this gene-environment interaction. And so, like we made the case at the beginning of the weekend, some people are afforded a different hand from birth, right? The genes that they are dealt up front. And that might set them up between those genes, their upbringing, culture, environment coming up, that may set them up on a trajectory that is more susceptible to this modern food environment, and they may be more prone to developing obesity due to factors both within and outside of their control. And other individuals may be dealt a hand that renders them more resistant. These are the folks who you know who are super lean no matter what they eat, no matter what they do. right? The people that are praised by society for being, you know, paragons of virtue and self-control, even though it's probably just their genes in the context of the environment, that's just what happens to them, right? They couldn't develop obesity if they tried in some situations, right? And that's not because they're better people than anybody else, just the hand they were dealt in the current environment, and other people are in a different situation.
Yeah, if our culture rewarded a different body composition, they would be
failures. It has in the past.
That's right.
You know, in the past, it used to reward, you know, larger bodies.
Yeah. But. One of the thoughts, and if you were muscular, you were a criminal. So it was like, well. One of the thoughts behind maybe some of the genetic components here and other recent changes is that body fatness, body composition was sort of, from an evolutionary standpoint, regulated based on this scale between. You didn't want to be so thin, so lean, so have so low body fat that if you got sick, you would die, right, or starve to death. So that sort of risk. And you didn't want to be so large, so slow that you'd become a predatory risk, right? And without this predation risk, we've had this genetic drift towards more and more. And that's happened over longer than 50 to 100 years. That's been a long, long time coming, you know. Animals have not been like really
attacking humans in large numbers.
Correct. Yes. And now this modern food environment has basically, kind of pounced upon this genetic drift. So, yeah,
there's a lot of interesting hypotheses around that. For sure.
Agreed. Okay. If you are a rehab/medical professional who found the information in the pain lecture challenging and totally new, how do you grapple with the new information, rethink your practice, and move into a more evidence-based worldview and set of treatments? I think you just ignore it. Are you familiar with ostriches? You just bury your head. Is that not what you were going to say?
No. I think that the fact that this question is being asked represents a substantial amount of intellectual maturity because the natural cognitive bias that we would have, the lizard brain, what it would want to do would be to ignore that and to say, what I'm doing works for my patients. What I do, I see it work every time, and that's what gets me paid, and so I'm going to keep doing that. And these guys don't see my patients, right? They don't do what I do. I'm special. I'm going to keep doing that. We have been in these arguments before, if you can't tell. We have been in these discussions before. But again, this illustrates to me that this person is open to the possibility that they may not have it totally figured out. Kind of like how I said in the lecture, nobody has it totally figured out, myself included, and I'm the person giving the lecture. You guys are like, man, what a ripoff. I paid to be here and listen to somebody who said he doesn't have it all figured out, right? But that's kind of the point. That's where we are with our knowledge. There is always a substantial amount of uncertainty in clinical practice. Even in the stuff that I do every day, I have all kinds of hypothetical mechanisms of why did this patient's, you know, hemoglobin go up or down, or what, you know, was it because of what I did? Sure, I'd like to take credit for it. But I always have to consider, maybe it was just lab error or something like that. Maybe it was, you know, totally irrelevant to what I did for this person. I have to consider that possibility. Consider the possibility that my diagnosis is incorrect. Consider that they may be getting better in spite of my treatment or just because time is passing, not necessarily because of what I'm doing to them. Maybe the effects that I observe are not necessarily due to what I'm doing to the person, as much as I'd like to take credit for it and pat myself on the back, right? So this is respect for this kind of attitude. This is the same attitude I carry with, you know, even the stuff that I've been trained in and do every day and have done for several years now. So I think that's a good starting point. And I think being open to this stuff will lead you to the light, so to speak, here, as far as doing more reading, allowing your biases to be challenged, allowing all the stuff. I mean, you have to entertain the possibility that all the stuff you've been told before was incorrect or incomplete, and you have to be okay with that, right? Which can be a gut punch, right? Particularly if your salary depends on it, right? There's a quote about the hardest thing to do is to change somebody's mind when their salary depends on not understanding it, something to that effect, right? But I think we're starting from a good place, remaining curious, remaining open, really not, you know, being too prideful to change your mind or recognize that you are wrong. Those are kind of like the big things that I would suggest. I am very, very, very loosely attached to just about everything that I presented to you guys this weekend, right? Open to the possibility that we're wrong. And the degree of attachment that I might have to a given claim is not based on my professional identity, who I am, what I do, but rather to the strength of the evidence underlying it, right? So like when I presented the lipid lecture, I'm more attached to that because of the strength of the evidence that supports it, right? Compared to some of the other things, like I suspect that a fair amount of the stuff that Jordan mentioned in the programming lecture, if you asked him how attached are you to this hypothesis, he'd say, eh. Because there is not nearly as much evidence supporting some of that stuff in the programming realm as there is, for example, compared to the stuff that I presented in the lipid lecture. And that's just the way it is. That's just where we are right now. That's what should guide our confidence in our claims, is the amount of evidence we have to justify it, not how it makes us feel.
Yep. I mean, I think most interesting thing that's happened with me changing my mind on things relating to programming and nutrition is that then people are like, well, you're just a flip-flopper, you know, or you were just faking it before, or you're faking it now, or it's some secondary gain type thing. And I'm like, it's fine to change your mind. I encourage it. If I was still doing the same thing 10 years from now, man, I would really would have missed the boat, you know. But then some of these people are like, nope, still the same. Last 20 years. I'm like, a lot of stuff has happened though. You should maybe update your priors. All right. Let's see. In an ideal world, easy, safe, and cheap tests for physiological correlates to performance, assuming those exist. Could we stratify sports competition by physiology, i.e. lean body mass, VO2 max, height, etc., to make competition fair? Why are they asking me this?
I figured this is a question you would nerd out more than me.
I mean, you could. So you, if you were the president of a sports organization, could do whatever you want, right? Because they're currently just, you know, private entities. As far as would it be a worthwhile endeavor, well, that just depends on why you think sports exist in the first place. Are they for commercial interests to flourish? Is it for the spirit of the game, right? Do you subscribe to the Olympic Charter that inclusion and participation are, you know, the primary factors in athletics? Like, I don't know. It depends how you view this stuff. So I don't know that you need to have competitions or sports separated by body height, like you have a tall NBA league and a short NBA league, or you have like runners with high VO2 maxes versus low VO2 maxes. Like, do you have separate Olympics? Do you have like, you know, what's the SNL skit, like the all drug Olympics? You know, like, I really just think it depends on what the goal of sport is. I think right now, the way we have divisions in most sports, there's usually a gender division, and there tends to be skill division, so either amateur and professional, or multiple like subcategories of amateurs. Sometimes in physique sports there's height division. I mean, you know, these are all made up, right? And so you'd just be making up other divisions. We're assuming that a lot of these things make competition more fair, but then you have to define what fair means and what are you prioritizing? I don't know that I have a good answer for this. I will tell you, if you are interested in this question and similar questions, there are two books I would recommend reading. One is called Sport in Society. It talks about the societal impact of sport and then the impact of society on sport. Edge by Robert Pike Jr. Both of those books explore this topic and similar topics pretty in depth, and I think you could get some interesting ideas about that. As far as what I would do, I would convene a panel of actual experts across many different fields and try to come up with something that everybody agreed upon, because anything I would come up with would have untoward knock-on effects that I couldn't possibly foresee, because I am only an expert in a very small niche in the realm of athletics. What would you do?
I would first say sports aren't fair. Just period. Right? And then I would add a reading recommendation on top of what you said.
Sure.
A dystopian short story by the name of Harrison Bergeron. Has anybody here read this? Yes. Fascinating dystopian story. Basically, it was the most fair, equal society imaginable. People who were too smart would have things implanted in their ears that would buzz off noises at a given frequency, so people who were too smart could not think enough to demonstrate that. People who could jump too high would have weights attached to their ankles, so they could not jump as high. Everything was made exactly perfectly equal. It sounds f***ing horrible.
No, but it's fair, though.
But it was fair. But it was fair. Yeah, sports aren't fair. They're never going to be fair. They should not be fair from this sort of a perspective, right? If you had perfectly equally matched physiological parameters, are you trying to get this to the point where everybody just lifts the same amount of weight? Or swims just as fast. It's just a tie, first place to eighth place. The whole heat finishes at the exact same time.
It's the NASCAR approach. Like, you were using a stock car with a restrictor plate, and then, you know, see who the best driver is.
Yeah. But so this gets back to what Jordan was saying. What do you mean by fair, and what is the point of sport? Right? There's going to be somebody who wins and somebody who doesn't. There must be some level of unfairness on some level. Right? Unless we're going to start genetically editing everybody to have the same genes, the same upbringing, the same access to training, the same coaching, all this other stuff, right? That's super fair. Be a very uninteresting sport to watch. So what is the point of sport, right? Yeah. Sports aren't fair. Deal with it.
Yeah, or don't.
Yeah.
All right, that's a wrap on episode 159. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks to Dr. Baraki, Tom Capitelli, and Alan Thrall at Untamed Strength for letting us use his gym, Tom Capitelli for running the AV stuff, and Dr. Baraki for entertaining or allowing me to jut in with my commentary on this Q&A. Before you go anywhere, leave us a 5-star rating and a review wherever you're getting this podcast from. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast. Consider sharing it with a friend. That would be useful so we can help keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. We'll see you guys next week for part 2 of the podcast and an update on my training rehab. Thanks again. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody in the States. Have a great week.
Know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.